Hello and welcome back to the Security Metrics Podcast. My name is Jen Stone. I'm one of the principal security analysts here at Security Metrics. Very excited to bring you the topic today, which is all about how PCI version 4.0 will impact university payment processing. If you are a new listener or follower, welcome. Very excited to have you here. We have a lot of topics that really run the gamut of compliance, security, risk. And so there should be a little something here for you regardless of what role you hold in your company. We have a lot of universities that come to us with questions about PCI. And I have with me today Michael Simpson, who is, he's kind of the king of university audits. So very, I don't even know. Do you want to introduce yourself a little bit, Michael?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I'm Michael Simpson. I've been with Security Metrics for, I don't know, over 11 years now doing PCI assessments. Before that, I came from the university world. So I was a database engineer, network engineer for a university for about 10, 11 years. So kind of understand how that university space works. And then I moved into mostly PCI assessments, but security assessments in general. And it's been great. I love working with universities. Right now, I'm the director of our enterprise audit or enterprise assessment team, and we focus on our university clients, our large enterprise clients, and our government clients. So, pretty much any time we're doing an assessment where we're sending out multiple assessors, and the universities tend to be that route, it usually ends up on my team's plate.
Yeah, and I'm excited to be part of that team. It's actually some of the most fun and interesting work that we do is some of these large, more complex audits. And universities are their own special thing. A lot of people don't understand why universities are harder, but I think part of it is because they're a conglomeration of a lot of little merchants.
Yeah. Yeah, I call it, you know, it's a multi-mid assessment. So they have all of these merchant accounts, sometimes hundreds of merchant accounts. It acts a lot like a little city,
yeah,
or a big city, you know.
And a lot of times there's distributed decision-making too. So you don't have like one person saying or one group saying, here's the processes we're all going to follow. And so that adds a little bit of spice to what we're looking at. But so let's talk about, before we really dive into how it affects universities, maybe kind of talk about the 4.0 timeline, because people are wondering, when do I have to care about this?
Yeah, no, that's a great question. 4.0, you should have started caring about it probably about a year ago. But it's not too late. It's good to start, you know, thinking about it now. We have until March of next year, before March of 2024, that's when version 3.2.1 will be retired. And at that point, you will have to do version 4 assessments. There's another timeline, which is a year after that, March 31st of 2025. And that's when all of these brand new future dated requirements will need to be put in place. Up until that point, they're considered a best practice. So from a scheduling standpoint, those are the two dates to really worry about, is next March and the March after that.
Right. And so in PCI, there's kind of two different ways to report on it. And that is the SAQ, the self-assessment questionnaire, versus the ROC, or the report on compliance. Typically, and a self-assessment questionnaire might even be a little confusing, because you can have a QSA come and evaluate you, you do and fill out your SAQs and sign that. You have to have a QSA do the ROC. But then there's like self-assessment, as it infers, if you're small enough or maybe low risk enough, your bank will allow you to do a self-signed SAQ. So how do those different ways of assessing, how does that apply to the university environment?
Yeah, so that's a good question. And this is something that maybe is not universally adopted. But in my opinion, the best way to review a university environment from a compliance standpoint is to look at each of your merchant accounts and identify which self-assessment questionnaire fits that particular merchant account. Even if at the end your product that you're going to turn into your bank is a ROC or an AOC from a ROC, it helps to really identify which PCI requirements apply to specific payment flows so that you can work with those merchants on campus and say, you know, because you have an e-commerce payment flow and you're using an iframe from your third-party provider, you know, this payment flow would be, if you were using an SAQ to assess it, it'd be the SAQ AEP. So these are the security controls from the standard mm-hmm. that we should really focus in on. Instead of throwing the whole standard at them and saying, okay, you guys need to meet everything here. Sometimes, you know, a lot of those aren't going to apply. So if you could look at each of your merchant accounts, look at each payment flow and say, okay, this payment flow, this is an SAQ B type payment flow. Mm-hmm. So I don't need to worry about network security controls. And I don't need to worry about unauthorized wireless devices. You know, this is an analog connected terminal. I mostly need to worry about physical security and staff training. So the SAQs, even if you're not turning in an SAQ at the end of your assessment process, it really helps you to define your merchant environment as a whole and to really understand which PCI requirements need to be put in place to protect each of those payment flows.
I think it's a really good way to do it too, because you're not overwhelming the individual merchants or individual departments with questions they don't know how to answer. You know, if you have, let's say the marching band takes payments using point-to-point encrypted terminals, and then you go and ask them, well, how do you deal with Rogue Wireless? And they're like, what? We don't even, what does that even mean? That doesn't have anything to do with
right.
that, right? And so it helps support the and not overwhelm the merchants while gathering the actually applicable things that you need to know. So I just think it's a really smart way to do it. So then a lot of organizations, the universities have been doing this way, especially the ones that we work with, have been doing it this way. And so they actually care about the SAQs. So at this point, they're probably saying, all right, we know how to answer an SAQ, but there's changes that are happening. What are these changes to the SAQs that they need to know about?
Yeah, so any time the standard changes, and it's been a few years since we've had a major change to the standard, but the PCI Council, not only will they decide, you know, which of these new PCI requirements that are brand new to version 4 should we put into which SAQ, mm-hmm. they'll also say, you know, we probably should also add this existing PCI requirement that's been part of version 3.2.1 that hasn't been in this SAQ. It really makes sense to bring that in. So when you're going through an SAQ based approach, and we're going through these standard changes, there's, you know, two types of requirements we need to keep an eye out. One is for brand new requirements. And those, like I said, usually we have until March 31st of 2025 for most of those new requirements before those have to be put in place. But if they take an existing requirement, one example of this is with the SAQAs, the external vulnerability scan used to not be a requirement that SAQA merchants had to do. But the council, when they were making this 4.0 change, they're like, you know, really, these e-commerce websites should have an ASV scanned on them every quarter. So they grab that requirement, they added it to the SAQA. So when you do an assessment to version 4, if next year you're doing your first version 4 assessment, even though that's a newly added requirement to the SAQA, it's not seen as a new requirement and it needs to be put in place on day one.
Right, because you know, it was always a requirement. And I've heard you say this over and over again. It's not that you don't have to meet requirements if you're an SAQA or if you're filling out the SAQs. It's not that you don't have to meet a requirement if it's applicable in your environment. You just don't have to attest to it. And so I think that makes a lot of sense where people, well, it is a new requirement. It's not. You just now have to attest to it in places where you didn't have to attest to it before.
Yeah. And unfortunately, I mean, it's the way of compliance. If people are not attesting to it, it's easy just to ignore it.
Yeah.
But there is a little CYA statement that's been in the SAQs forever that just says, you know, even though I'm only attesting to these requirements, I need to be compliant to all applicable PCI DSS controls.
And I can feel the eye rolls from here, guys. I know. It's like, what are you talking about? It feels kind of like a sophistry, but it really is. That's the way it goes. And trying to help people understand that things are applicable. But there are a lot of people that we work with, a lot of groups that we work with who already get this, who have already been doing it, and who have actually gone that extra step of, look, we know that this is a security concern in our environment, even though we haven't been attesting to it. We've been doing these things. And so for some groups, this is going to be a super easy transition. But other groups, if they haven't been doing things like external vulnerability scans, it takes some ramp up to do that. And so people need to be aware of it now so they can be prepared for it. I mean, I'm glad you talked about the SAQA. Let's talk about maybe some other changes to the SAQA, because I feel like the SAQA used to be kind of one of the easiest ones, because a lot of SAQAs, they were relying on iframes, for example. But there are changes that we have to be aware of, because this is where the breaches are happening now. This is where we're seeing actual malicious activity is in groups that are using the SAQA. And so they need to know what these changes are, because they're addressing real problems, not just, oh, we think this might be a problem in the future. Nope, it's happening now. So what are some of the other changes to the SAQA that people really need to be aware of?
Yeah, so one of the biggest changes to the SAQA, there's two new security requirements that are designed to prevent an e-commerce skimming attack a man-in-the-middle type of attack. Requirement 643 and 1161, and these kind of interplay, they kind of relate to each other. Both of these new requirements, they only apply if you're using a third-party iframe to capture payment data. Mm-hmm. So if you're an SAQA, which basically an SAQA merchant, they've outsourced all collection, processing, and transmission to a third-party provider. If you've done that, if you're e-commerce and you've done that by fully redirecting a browser, so the customer's on your website, they're selecting what they want to purchase, and then you redirect them out to that third party to make the payment. And then after the payment's done, they get redirected back to your site. Mm-hmm. If that happens, these requirements don't apply to you.
Right.
Because you're not really the target of these types of attacks. But for e-commerce merchants who have outsourced the collection by implementing a third-party iframe, which is a little piece of code they put on their site, right, then when I'm a customer and on your site, your web server is saying, hey, this is what I want you to display to the user. I want you to go out to this, website and pull some code here, and go out to this other website, pull some code, go out here and pull in this iframe that's coming from the payment gateway. These controls are to look at all of that code that you're telling my browser what to load. Mm-hmm. Because if one of those third parties gets compromised, or those code repositories, and you tell me, my browser, hey, go over here and pull this compromised code in, some of that code might be also skimming or scraping the same information, my payment data that I'm putting into that iframe on your site, another piece of code might also be taking that same information. Yeah. So as a result, there's some security controls where we need to really understand what are all of these pieces of code that we're asking our customer's browser to pull in.
Yeah.
And we need to have a way to check to make sure that there's no unauthorized changes or malicious code that's being introduced into that environment. Right. And that is a weekly check, at least weekly check that'll have to be done. So a big change for most of our SAQA customers tend to not, they went to SAQA because they didn't want to have to deal with a lot of compliance, and maybe they don't have a lot of technical expertise there. So for some of these merchants, this is going to be a very heavy, very technical lift for them to deal with.
Right. And I think there's another gotcha in there, where some universities are creating that web page that hosts the iframe. And so, of course, they're going to be responsible. There are some who have a third party create that web page that hosts the iframe. And here's what I'm seeing a lot, is that third party that creates the web page that hosts the iframe will tell universities they're not in scope for PCI.
Yep.
They'll tell them there's nothing there that they need to be doing. And it's absolutely not true, because if they're unaware of this protection of that page, the issues that we're seeing there, they're going to put the university at risk. And also, the university might say, well, is this really that big a deal? Can we just take a self-signed service provider SAQ from them? I'm going to say you shouldn't. It's a big risk. So this is one of those things that I would like to see when we start talking about targeted risks analyses, which is part of 4.0. You need to do an analysis of risk. If you have a third party that's hosting that web page and they're going to give you a self-signed SAQ, I don't think in a lot of cases they have enough expertise either in cybersecurity or in PCI for you to be able to successfully take that and say, yes, this meets the risk appetite of the university. And that's right. Going to be another difficult thing, because a lot of these little departments have been working with, you know, this small mom and pop shop that does that hosting for them. And so that's going to have to be a conversation where groups are going to have to recognize this is an actual risk to the university, because that's where we're seeing breaches happen.
Which that actually reminds me of another SAQA change that really doesn't hit any of the lists that the council says, oh, here's the changes, because it's not a new requirement, and it's not even a requirement in per se, but every self-assessment questionnaire has an eligibility to complete list. Yeah. Where it says, you know, to be eligible for the SAQA, you have to, you know, and there's like four or five statements where you have to be able to check a box saying, yes, this applies to me. Yes, this applies to me. One of those statements that changed just a little bit in version 3.2.1, it says, you know, my third party providers who I am outsourcing the collection and processing of payment data to, they're PCI compliant. In SAQA version 4.0, it says that not only are they compliant, but I've received, you know, their attestation of compliance. So we can't just, you know, take their word that they're PCI compliant. We can't even look at, you know, like the Visa Global Registry. We actually need to see some type of validation that they are PCI compliant. Technically, like you were saying, we can accept a self-validated SAQ from a third-party provider, but merchants really should realize that there is risk there. If they're allowing a self-validated service provider, some of them are more conscientious than others. Some of them might be trying their best and maybe just not understanding the requirements. But too often in the SAQA world, we do get those instances where the third party says, hey, I don't store, process, or transmit. I'm not in scope at all, even though they're the ones hosting, you know, this website that has the payment iframe attached to it.
One of the red flags there is if you ask your hosting provider to give you an SAQ and they give you an SAQA and they don't give you something from a service provider perspective, that's a big red flag. It tells you they really don't understand enough to be able to give you a self-signed SAQ. So I think we're kind of focusing on the SAQA a lot right now, because this is where I think we're going to see some real challenges to universities, and it needs to be thought through carefully at this point.
And it is the SAQ that has seen the most changes, mm-hmm. with the version 4 change. You know, the SAQB, the P2PE, the BIP, fairly unchanged.
Right.
You know, there are some other ones like the SAQ CVT, the C, and the AEP that have seen some changes. But most of the changes for most of our university clients is that the A's that are really going to be their big lift in 4.0.
This episode is brought to you by our Security Metrics Penetration Testing Team. They do a lot of pen tests. They do a lot, like network layer, application layer, segmentation checks. They're very, very knowledgeable. And some of them have even won like competitions at DEF CON. So you can rely on these guys to know what they're doing. Head over to securitymetrics.com, learn more about pen testing. And maybe we should talk about now some of the changes to the SAQ CVT that they'll need to be aware of. So these are people who are using the virtual terminal to enter in credit card data from a system that's owned by the university personnel. So what there do you think people need to be aware of?
So the biggest thing that I've seen there, you know, so I guess first off, the biggest problem at university that I see with virtual terminals is the fact that most CVTs on campus tend to be accidental. You know, they've got staff that
yes.
It should be an SAQA environment, but they're being overly helpful and they're using their computers to enter it. Yeah. So first we need to realize that, you know, if you're using a staff workstation to enter data, or if you set up a kiosk, you know, that should be a CVT type environment.
Yes.
But as far as the changes to version 4.0, there's with PCI version 4, they've made some policy enhancement changes. So for each sub requirement, you know, requirement one deals with network security. They want to know that you have identified who's in charge of your firewalls or who's in charge of your network security controls for that environment, and what policies or procedures do they have to follow to help them to do that in a PCI compliant manner.
Right.
So that's a new slight change that we're seeing in the SAQ CVT for version 4. We do also have some future dated requirements that have been on there. One is that, you know, we've always had a requirement where antivirus solution needs to be installed on a CVT workstation. Mm-hmm. That antivirus solution now, there's a separate sub requirement that says, you know, if you allow for like USB or any removable electronic media to connect to that CVT workstation, your antivirus needs to be configured to protect that as well.
Right.
So you plug something in, it's going to scan it and make sure that it's safe. Phishing prevention, and this is a weird one for a lot of people that have been doing PCI for a while. Usually in the PCI world, we're used to saying, okay, what are the systems that are in scope, and then what controls do we need to validate on those? Mm-hmm. In PCI version 4, phishing prevention has been brought in. And usually, you know, the way that we prevent phishing attacks is by looking at the email server. You know, how can we prevent these emails from getting to our staff, or how can we protect the staff if they click on one of these links that are in their email?
Yeah.
But usually, you know, we've been trying for years, hey, keep your email system out of scope. You know, you don't want that in your PCI environment. But even though, you know, you can have your email system out of scope, we still need to help staff to, you know, be protected from these phishing attacks, both through training and through technical controls. Mm-hmm. So that's one technical control that will be brought into the CVT.
Yeah, and I think it's important because phishing, social engineering in general, is just exploding. You know, that's one of the other places where we're seeing successful attacks executed.
Surprisingly enough, 10 years ago when I started, people would complain about, we have to train our staff every year. We trained them last year. Why do we have to do it again this year? But now that people at their homes are getting these attacks all the time,
yeah,
it's more understandable. I think that, yes, we do need to make sure we're training our staff to know what's out there and how to protect themselves and how to protect us as an institution.
And, you know, if it's done in a way that's applicable to the people, not just for their jobs, but also, hey, this is how it translates into at your home for your family. Yeah. I think training becomes something that is valuable and people appreciate knowing more how to protect themselves from being phished, from these social engineering attacks.
Mm-hmm.
What does future dated mean?
So future dated, whenever there's one of these standard changes and the council comes up with brand new security requirements we haven't seen in the standard before, they want to be sure that companies have plenty of lead time to get these in place. Because sometimes this is going to require, you know, substantial expenditures depending on the environment and what type of equipment would need to be purchased and installed, or substantial changes to how, you know, you manage processes. Hopefully your phishing prevention has been part of your security awareness training for a while. But, you know, for companies that have a big training program, maybe it's going to take them a little bit of time to get some of these things in place. So the council gives them a bit of lead time to get that in place. So it's kind of a, hey, this is something we're seeing problems with. We need to address it. By March 31st, 2025, we need something to be put in place to protect against this. So it gives companies time to really research and figure out what is the best way for us to address this new security requirement and put it in place. So hopefully they're already in place or something that you can get in place pretty quickly. So I would, future dated requirements, I don't think should ever just be put off. Oh, we can worry about that next year. You know, get it in place if you can. But they do give you until March of 2025 in case it takes you some time to get that in place.
Right. So let's shift gears a little bit and focus more on changes to the ROC. You know, one of the misconceptions I've seen is that people think the SAQs are different from the ROC in some way, but they're not. They're just specific subsets that the council has carved out based on risk associated to specific data flows. But the ROC is the full set of things, right? So understanding the ROC can help people who have multiple SAQs, like a university environment. Right. So I think it's definitely worth talking about. So big picture changes in the ROC. What are some of the kind of overarching changes we need to know about?
Yeah. So one of them we've talked about a little bit with the CVT, and it's just defining who's responsible to make sure security requirements are in place and what policies and procedures guide those. So we're in the ROC, we see at the beginning of every section, you know, what group is responsible for your firewall controls, or what group is responsible for hardening systems, or for log monitoring and review. You know, we need to be sure that merchants or service providers are defining who's responsible to make sure these controls are in place and that we have policies and procedures that guide them. So that's one thing that you'll see throughout the full standard in PCI version 4. We kind of saw it in version 3.2.1, but it's much more formalized in version 4.
It can't just be you have somebody responsible, but they're responsible for everything. Instead, there might be teams or individuals that are more responsible for passwords and others that are more responsible for encryption of data, right? So
yeah.
So it kind of refines that understanding a little bit, I think.
Yes. Yep. No, that is a great one. Another one that I've seen, and you mentioned, you know, the targeted risk assessment in PCI version 3.2.1. And this is something, you know, both of those requirements are, you know, the first time you do a version 4 assessment, they're not future dated. They just need to be put in place. But the risk assessment prior to version 4 in PCI, there was a requirement that some type of risk assessment was being performed on an annual basis. The standard did give some suggestions on different frameworks that could be used, but it was pretty much up to the merchant to decide what they wanted to do for the risk assessment. And it didn't necessarily say it needed to be PCI focused or, you know, their risk assessment could mostly be, you know, what are we going to do if there's an earthquake, or what are we going to do if there's a fire, you know? So in version 4, they've changed that overall, you know, risk assessment to targeted risk assessments, where we're looking at specific items throughout the standard. And most of them are items in the standard where they've asked you to do something on a periodic basis, but they didn't tell you what periodic means.
Yes.
In version 4, you decide what periodic means based on your risk. Right. You know, so for terminal inspections, if you're a service station and you've got terminals that are out in the public space and there's not a lot of supervision, you probably have much more risk than a university environment where there's, you know, a small analog device on Janet's desk, you know, in a locked office area. Mm-hmm. So based on your risk, you decide, maybe for Janet, a quarterly inspection of that device is totally fine. But for the service station, quarterly inspection would be negligent.
Exactly.
You know, so their risk assessment needs to define that. So that's something that we'll see in PCI version 4 is those targeted risk assessments.
And I know as an assessor, I'm going to want to see that documented. I'm going to want to see why are you doing this at this frequency, and hopefully some sort of a sign off. Like, this is what we who are closest to the idea of risk believe is the actual risk for this. So like you said, you know, there's a locked drawer device, right? So there's some sort of a risk analysis performed and written up, and then somebody who is in responsibility level, somebody in authority, looks at that assessment of risk and says, yeah, I can get behind that idea. I think that that makes perfect sense for what you've decided to do. And then some sort of a signature, right? So even though PCI doesn't define these things, as rational humans, we'd want to look at why are we doing this and what gives us the uplift from doing targeted risk analyses. And having it documented that way, it also makes it so, okay, we've decided to do this. Somebody else over here says, well, why did you do it like that? Look, here's our decision. And then on an annual basis, you can reevaluate it and say, here's what we decided last year. Does this still make sense based on how we do things? Oh, no, we've changed it in this and this and this way. We think we need to modify it in this way. And so you have kind of a visual aid for the decision-making process regarding risk. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. And those are really the two, like if I were preparing for a PCI version for a rock, you know, to happen soon, those are the two policy process changes that I would really focus in on first,
yeah,
because they need to be put in place initially when we do that assessment. Some of the requirements that we've talked about, like preventing e-commerce skimming, there's new requirements over using how we deal with hashing. You know, we need to have keyed cryptographic hashing in version 4. You know, a lot of these new technical requirements we have until 2025. Mm-hmm. You know, if they're not in place right when we first do our initial assessment, those are considered best practice. So the first thing I would suggest, though, is looking at those things that we know, you know, what do we have to validate when we do our first PCI version 4? Let's make sure those are in tight. And then let's start looking at these future dated requirements and see what we could get in place.
For sure. Well, why don't we wrap up with a quick hit of the top changes by section. So I'll give you a section. You tell me the top changes for it.
Okay.
So starting with section 3, which is all about protecting stored cardholder data, what are the biggest changes there?
Yeah, so there's really two big changes that I've seen there. One of them in PCI version 3.2.1, there was a requirement that said that if we have stored credit card data in our environment and people can remote into the environment, mm-hmm, we needed to have controls to show, you know, who could remote into that environment. But the controls that were there before, it said that, you know, people shouldn't be copying data locally to their drive if they're remoting in. PCI version 4 has kind of put a little more emphasis on that. We now, it's not just a policy thing. We need to have technical controls that prevent someone, if they're remoting into the environment, to be able to download or copy PAN data on their local systems.
Right.
So that's one requirement. The other one is that hashing, the hashing algorithm. If you are storing hashed PAN data in version 4, and we don't have to go through your old hashed data and rehash stuff, but once we get to, you know, March 31st of 2025, that hashing algorithm that you're using, if you're storing a hash of the PAN, it needs to be a cryptographically secure or a keyed crypto hashing algorithm.
Right. But also, if you're using a university, why are you storing? Don't store.
Yes.
That is not the expertise of a university. Have somebody who has expertise in storing. If you need to store, use a third party.
Yes.
So not to get sassy, I do have an opinion on that one. Okay, section 4, which is all about transmitting cardholder data. What is the big changes we need to know about there?
Yeah, really the biggest change there, and there's a few areas throughout the report or throughout the ROC where we'll see there's more of an emphasis in our inventories. One place we see that is in section 4. We need to have an inventory of all of the encrypting algorithms that we're using, all of the certificates that we're using. Mm-hmm. So all of that, we need to have an inventory so we know what certificates we have, when those certificates expire, who gave us those certificates. So that type of information needs to be documented.
Right.
And we should be looking at that periodically. And similar to that, but this is probably more of a section 2 item, in PCI version 3.2.1, we had to have an inventory of our devices and our payment applications, our applications in general. So it's hardware, software inventory. In PCI version 4, that needs to be much more detailed. You know, we need to have like end of life date for all of the software that we have in our environment, all the hardware environment. So, you know, if we have, you know, a Cisco ASA firewall, we should know exactly when that firewall is not going to be supported anymore so that we can plan for the future.
Yeah. I love the idea of more detailed inventory because as an assessor, if I try to evaluate security controls in an environment, but I don't know exactly what versions and what flavors of things, then there's different ways to properly protect from a technical security standpoint. So having those inventories, it's going to be very helpful. And also, like, how from the security team's standpoint, if they don't know, how are they properly protecting it? So
yeah.
Should be helpful. I know it sounds like a lot of work, and it probably is. So
yes.
Section five is all about malware protections. So what are the big changes there?
Yeah, so the biggest changes in 5, we've talked about some of them, you know, like the scanning removable drives, that's new to PCI version 4. The biggest one, though, and we talked a bit about this, is the phishing prevention. So phishing prevention, it's addressed in two different places in Section 5. One of it's from a training aspect. So your security awareness training needs to have, you know, social engineering and phishing prevention included in the training. But it's not just going to be, hey, you know, we've trained you, now it's your responsibility as a employee to protect us from phishing. There needs to be some technical control also put in place where, you know, you're trying to help protect your employees from phishing attacks as well.
Right. So I came from the IT operations side of the house, and I have been as guilty of this as any IT group. And that is sometimes the IT group will throw changes in and then the users are like, oh, they changed another thing, but without properly socializing it. And so it's almost like you're training your people to expect, oh, well, there's an unexpected thing that IT probably did, when it's actually some sort of phishing or some sort of an issue that they should report, but they don't know that they should report it. And so part of that training is anytime you get something that looks a little suspect, then there should be a mechanism or a pathway or process that they can turn around and say to the IT group, did you guys do this? Is this legitimate? And that also helps the technology group turn around and say, all right, we want to not get 6 million emails asking us if this is legitimate. Maybe we should inform people first. So it kind of creates a positive cycle of communication that makes it easier for employees to know when they're getting phished.
Yeah, I've seen a funny implementation of one of these teaching controls where, you know, they send out these test emails to see if their staff are going to click on the links. But the ones that do click on the links, they send them another email saying, hey, you know, you failed this phishing test by clicking on a link that you didn't know. Click on this link and take this training. So you're asking them to click on another link that they don't know that's supposed to be there. So
exactly.
So maybe you have to kind of think of, you know, what is the best way to help my people learn about phishing?
What am I actually teaching them to do? And the people that click on the phishing links, unfortunately, tend to be the people who are most conscientious and most helpful and are trying to do good work and are trying to do it quickly. And so then we turn around and punish them with more training. So
it's that. Or the people that like cat videos. You know,
they're the good, you know, I do fall for a good cat video for sure. Okay, PCI DSS Section 6, which is all about, well, Section 6 is a weird one because it combines patching with software development, which I've never thought that those two go together, but here they are in PCI bumping along together. So what are the top changes for Section 6?
Yeah, so this is another area where we're seeing inventory changes or enhancements. And one of them is what we talked about with the SAQA. In addition to having, you know, that detailed inventory of all of our hardware, software in the environment, we also need to have an inventory of any third-party code that we're including on our sites. So that's probably the biggest change that I've seen in Section 6. Another change I noticed in Section 6, when it came to patch management, PCI version 3.2.1 really focused in on those high and critical patches, making sure that those are patched within 30 days of a patch release. And then everything else, you know, should be patched at some future date, you know, but it didn't really dive into that. PCI version 4, and this is another one of those targeted risk assessment things. We need to know, okay, so high and criticals, we do need to address those within 30 days. How quickly should we be addressing our medium and lows? Mm-hmm. And that's really your risk assessment that should be defining that. And then we need to verify that you're following your policies and processes.
Right.
So that's the biggest changes that I've noticed in Section 6.
Agreed. So let's jump to Section 8. So authorization.
Yeah, so Section 8, one of the big ones that universities definitely will come across, anyone that's using a password to log in. For a long time, the PCI standard may have been a little bit behind from a security standpoint in the length of a password. So it used to be 7 characters by 2025, so we still have quite a bit of time, but we'll need to increase to 12 characters on those passwords. The other change that we're seeing is multi-factor authentication. In PCI version 3.2.1, there was a requirement to have, you know, if you're remoting into a CDE environment or a CDE system, somewhere along that authentication change, we would need to have multi-factor authentication in place. So, you know, if you first connected to a VPN and, you know, the VPN enforced multi-factor, then you can, you know, remote desktop onto a system and you wouldn't have to do another multi-factor. In PCI version 4, we need to have multi-factor authentication in place anytime you're remoting into a network. So if, you know, if that VPN is putting you on the CDE, multi-factor is needed there. And then even in the CDE, if we then remote onto one of the servers in the CDE, we need to have multi-factor in place for that as well. So in some places, we may need to add multi-factor authentication where maybe it wasn't in place under version 3.
Right. Right. And see, so a lot of people get confused there about what multi-factor actually is. And I know this isn't a multi-factor podcast, but I think it's worth just saying it's very simple. It's something you have, something you know, something you are. And so something you have infers something physical, but sometimes we allow the digital token.
So, right.
Something you know is usually username and password, and something you are is typically some kind of biometric. So a facial scan or a fingerprint, something like that. And so it's not like you can't have multi-factor is not, oh, I'm going to do a password here and then I'm going to do another password at the next step. No, that's something you know and something you know. And the reason that we want different types of things is somebody, you know, just kind of calling back to that phishing idea, somebody can get out of you something you know and something you know. They can you know, you get in the right situation and then you're spilling all, yes, this is my password and this is my username. And oh, and here's, you need the SMS code? Here, let me read that off to you, right? And so so if you kind of think about where multi-factor authentication is applicable, you're going to want to do a little bit of a threat assessment, threat analysis there, and kind of put into place what type of MFA is really going to be secure for that access to the CDE. So that's for what it's worth.
The other big change I'm seeing in version 4 assessments when it comes to Section 8 is they're putting a focus not just on user accounts, but also system and application accounts.
Which is great.
So, you know, the passwords that are used for those system accounts and even the permissions that are assigned to the system mm-hmm. account, there needs to be a process in place where you're periodically reviewing, you know, what system accounts do I have in place that should be inventoried? What permissions are assigned to each of those accounts? And are those permissions appropriate for the level of access that that account really needs? Mm-hmm. And how am I handling authentication for those application or system accounts?
And I think that's a valid addition or kind of bulking up on that one, because system and software passwords are kind of invisible to a lot of people. They don't really look at them. So that's a good addition.
Once they put them in, they kind of forget they're even there.
All right. Okay, moving on to, let's go to Section 10. Section 10 is all about logging, monitoring, and alerting. And so it's a super important section. What are you seeing there for big changes?
Yeah, so the biggest one, and this shouldn't be, this is one of those duh requirements that maybe, you know, we shouldn't have been doing for a long time. But in PCI version 3.2.1 for log review, it could either be an automated process or a manual process, which I've never seen a manual log review process that does any good.
That's insane.
So in by 2025, you can't say, oh, yes, I'm manually looking at all of my logs, and that's my log review process.
Uh-huh.
There needs to be an automated solution, some type of SIM solution, or, you know, where AI or whatever, some solution is looking through the logs for you and saying, hey, this is something you should look at as the human.
Yeah.
You know, so we're having the computer help us define the problems that we should be looking at instead of us reading through all of this stuff.
Right. Otherwise, it's just too hard to find indicators or compromise when you're doing it manually. It's just almost impossible.
Yeah. So that's a big one. The other one, and this is also for merchants, it is a new requirement. For service providers, it's not. In version 3.2.1, there was a service provider only requirement. We were looking for critical security control failures, you know, so like our ACLs or our firewalls, our logs review solution or our FIM, you know, all of these critical security controls, our antivirus. If all of a sudden our antivirus agents are no longer updating, we should get alerted to say, hey, there's a problem here. Look into that. If we're, you know, somehow our firewall gets stuck on a open any and just any traffic is going through, you know, there needs to be some way that we identify when one of these critical security controls fails. And then we need to have a process where we go in and not only fix it, but we identify, okay, how did that fail? Is there anything I can do to prevent that from failing in the future?
Right. I think that's a valuable control, especially what went wrong and how do we fix it in the future.
Right, that root cause analysis, something that comes into play there.
All right, we have only two sections left. Section 11, I think is one of the most important sections because it's all about the running reports, running scans, doing testing and proving that you're configurations, your policies, your procedures, your everything that we've talked about up until now, proving that it's actually working. So Section 11, what are the big changes there?
So one of the big change, I think the biggest change that people will run across in Section 11 is our internal vulnerability scans. You know, they have been a quarterly process. It still is quarterly, but now we're looking for authenticated scans. And the biggest difference there is, you know, unauthenticated scan is basically one computer kind of looking at another computer from afar off and saying, okay, what ports and services do you have open? You know, is there anything that I can see without being led onto that system where I can say, oh, you know, here's a vulnerability that needs to be identified, which is a valuable thing, you know, and they've been great. Authenticated scans just takes it one step further where that scanning engine is either authenticating to the device and scanning as an authorized user on the device. So it sees everything. It knows exactly what software is installed on that thing. It knows what patches have been installed. So nothing's hidden from that point. Or so it's either logging in or there's an agent sitting on the device that's scanning from inside of the computer itself and saying, here's all of my badness, you know, come and fix me. So that's going to be a new one. And this is one area, like with the ASV scans being added to the SAQAs.
Right.
If I was an SAQA, it's in the SAQA, I would still do it. You know, the vulnerability scan is probably it's a great way to protect your e-commerce servers. Even though it's not an SAQA thing, do it.
Yeah.
So that's one big thing. And then the other big thing, and we talked a little bit about this with the SAQAs, is that periodically scanning or checking all of the changes for any, if you have an e-commerce website, any third-party code that's included, that needs to be scanned. And this is different than like file integrity scans, because this code does not reside on your server. Mm-hmm. This is code that your server is telling my browser to load. So this needs to be really scanned from the endpoint standpoint, where you're pulling that in, just like your customer's browser would, scanning it, looking for any changes, looking for anything malicious. And that needs to be done on a weekly basis.
Right. Okay, then that leaves us with section 12. And section 12 is always about a lot of documentation and training and that type of thing. So what are the big changes there? The first one is my favorite one.
Yeah, so the first one, and this again, it shouldn't be new to anybody, because it was part of the executive summary in version 3.2.1, but scoping, performing a scoping exercise, annual scoping exercise for merchants, semi-annual for service providers, but having an exercise where you're looking at your whole environment and saying, what are the ways that we're receiving credit card data? Mm-hmm. What systems does it touch? Where are we storing data? Where are we sending data out? You know, going through that whole process so you know, the people and the systems that are involved in your payment environment, and you know what controls need to be put in place. Because of the fact that wasn't a requirement, too many merchants and service providers were relying on their QSA or their assessor to do their scoping for them. This really is something that the merchant or the service provider should be doing internally, and then their assessor should be validating that they did a good job.
Exactly. And I love this one because, again, it gets back to it, knowing what to protect. So if you have a good understanding of scope, then you have a good understanding of actual threats and vulnerabilities and what controls should be in place to provide security. So it for me, that's just the juice of the whole thing. What are we protecting? What's your scope?
Yeah.
Love the scoping exercise. I know that sounded super nerdy to you guys, but I also like me a good Excel spreadsheet. So
yeah.
All right. So give us our last big top change.
Yeah. So there's another new requirement that deals with, what do I do if I find credit card numbers being stored somewhere where I don't expect them to be stored? So this is very similar to in requirement 11, there's a requirement where we're looking for unauthorized wireless devices. And it says we should have an incident response plan that says, what do we do if we find an unauthorized wireless device plugged into our network? For this requirement, there should be some type of process where we're looking for this data. So we're scanning our logs to see if we're, for whatever reason, our e-commerce server's popping full payment data into our logs, or we're scanning our CVT workstations. We're, you know, scanning places where we really shouldn't be seeing stored credit card data. But if we do find data, there should be a defined response where we say, okay, you know, it's kind of that root cause analysis. How did that data get there? What can we do to prevent that from happening in the future? How long has that data been there? Has anyone had access to it? So there needs to be an incident response process tied to this as well.
I think it's a great addition for 4.0. And I know we've had a really long conversation. It's been pretty in-depth. If you stuck with it so far, gold stars all around. I think we need one more topic before we close, because it's new and it's different, and people are saying, how is this, help me understand this, and it's the customized approach validation method. I don't want to dive super deep into it, but I do want to give people a little bit of understanding of what that is.
If you're a university, don't do it.
There we go. All right. I actually agree with that statement, but maybe we'll tell people why.
Yeah. So a customized approach, this is different than a compensating control. A compensating control is where for whatever reason, you know, whether it's financial reasons or technical reasons, we cannot meet a specific PCI requirement the way it's written. Mm-hmm. So we find out, okay, well, this requirement was defined to help prevent what, you know, so we defined what it was designed to prevent, and we put in our own controls that help us to achieve the same status.
Right.
The difference here with the customized approach, maybe we have something that is better than what the standard is asking for.
Yeah.
You know, it's cutting edge technology. We have a better way of dealing with the same vulnerability or the same threat. We can go through and say, this is what we're doing. So we're looking at the original control. We're understanding what it's trying to prevent. And then we are writing, you know, this is what we have in place that helps us to prevent that. And we think it's better than what the PCI standard is asking us to do. And then we're going to work with our QSA. The QSA is going to look at it and say, yeah, I think that makes sense. This is how I'm going to test to make sure that you're actually doing what you say you're doing. So they need to come up with some testing requirements. And then all of that kind of needs to be packaged up together. So this is something where the merchant or service provider is working in conjunction with their QSA,
mm-hmm,
or with a QSA to define this customized approach and to define the testing process.
Right.
The reason why I said with a QSA and not their QSA is if your QSA helped you to define that customized approach, they should not be the QSA that's testing it to right. make sure you're actually, you know, that it's valid.
Yeah.
So a different QSA should be doing the testing so that the QSA is not testing their own work.
Agreed. So it can't be used for SAQs. It can only be used for rocks. And let me give people a specific example where they're saying, well, what do you mean by another way of doing things? This is not just best practices. There are organizations out there that have very carefully defined, they're following NIST CSF, for example, or ISO 12007, right? So, 12701, sorry. You guys know what I'm talking about if you're using it. But so there's a very specific defined way that they have developed their security program. And they want to follow that. And in a lot of these cases, their PCI is very, very gentle with people. It's like the minimum bar for protecting information, right? So there are a lot of places where they don't want to meet the minimum bar. They have a very compelling reason to meet a much stronger security standard. And so we don't want to come in and say, well, you have to do PCI, that this is what the customized approach is kind of respecting that understanding that, yes, there are other very secure ways, and we don't want to have you have to carve out your PCI environment and make it less secure than the standard way of doing things.
Yeah.
All right. Anything we've missed for today before we wrap up the whole conversation?
Well, PCI version 4 is here and it's coming, you know, so version 3.2.1 is going to be retired. I don't think for most merchants, this is not going to be all that big of a hurdle to get PCI version 4 compliance if you're already compliant to version 3.2.1. So don't be afraid of it. Start looking at it, start preparing for it. For most, especially our university merchants, if you've already done a good job of de-scoping and simplifying your environments, moving to SAQ P2PEs and AAs, you know, trying to not store credit card data locally, really the shift to version 4, there will be some work involved in getting there, but it doesn't have to be an onerous undertaking.
Right.
It's something that you can do. So don't put it off too long. But you can get there.
Great. Thank you so much for spending the time today to talk about it. And I hope I get to talk to you again soon.
Yeah. Thank you, Jen.
All right. Bye. Thanks for watching. To watch more episodes of Security Metrics Podcast, click on the box on the left. If you prefer to listen to this podcast, it's available on all your favorite podcast platforms. See you on the slopes.